brain systems.
Okay, yeah. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to be here in Santa Barbara. So in my talk, I will focus on cold matter. Cold means it's really at zero temperature, and I want to show you some, in my opinion, very unusual properties. And this matter is created by looking at proteins, and in particular we look at specific states, so-called compressible states. I will define all these technical terms later in my talk. And this talk is based on three different papers which I wrote. So the first one, together with Kristen Jensen, who is a postdoc in Victoria, Kim, he's now in Amsterdam, Joel Lyer, and Andy O'Bannon, who's a postdoc in Cambridge, so appeared like this August. And in this paper, we showed a very unusual property. Basically, and you will be shocked now, we found U1 instantons. And these are not non-commutative instantons. And I explain you later how this could have happened. And the second paper, which I unfortunately can only scratch the surface, is basically a paper with Matthias Kaminski and Andreas Karsch. Both are in Seattle. And the last paper I listed because this was basically the reason for why we wrote this paper here, and which I will mainly focus on. So this is basically work with the group in Munich and also with Andy O'Bannon. So we always should ask us, if you are interested in ADS-CFT or more general, like engaged gravity geologies, can we provide some new insights into real world systems? So can we say something about physics, like condensed matter physics? Can we say something about the quark gluon plasmon? Here, I will focus mainly on condensed matter systems, which are controlled by a quantum critical point. And as I said, I will focus on different matter states. And I hope that I convince you after the talk that at least we can say something very interesting. So yes, we definitely can say something, but it's probably a difficult path which we have to follow, and let's see what happens in the near future. So first I will give us motivation and will also explain a few technical terms in my title. Then, after a short review of the ADS-CFT correspondence, in particular about generalizations thereof, and first looking at flavor fields, I will introduce probe grains and some properties of those, and then I will specialize to a particular system, so-called the 3D7 system, at a finite baryon density, and show that this system has very unusual properties. But nevertheless, it turns out that the system, at least in the probe limit, is stable. And next, I will talk about one of these unusual properties of this D3D7 system, that a new gapless state basically appears in the spectrum. And we can trace back this gapless space to a kind of moduli space of the finite density systems. So I will show how this gravity description looks like in the D3D7 brain systems, and will then also say one or two slides about the other two systems which we investigated in more details. And these moduli spaces are interesting because somehow they give us a key ingredient to classify compressible states, at least the ones which arise in certain probe brain systems. And so here the last part I really make a conjecture, and the future will tell us whether this conjecture really holds or not. So let's see. And at the end I'll give a summary and some open questions which I find interesting and which I hope will be investigated in the near future. So how can we classify the states of quantum matter? And so I follow here basically mainly Sachdev. So he's saying, okay, if you have a kind of a quantum matter state, then it can be either a gapped quantum matter state, for example, this appears in the quantum Hall states, and also like in the bulk of topological insulators. And these gapped quantum matter states, they are described by topological field theories. So we know how to describe these gapped systems, gapped quantum matter systems. We also know how to describe the conformal matter systems, like, for example, graphene or cold atoms. So these systems are described by kind of conformal field theory. What we don't need know how to describe these systems, at least the interesting ones, are basically compressible quantum matter systems. And I will show you one nice example of this compressible quantum matter system, which we don't, or quantum matter state, which we don't understand. And so one task is now, can ADCFT help us to understand these quantum matter states? And that's basically the aim of that talk here. So what is such a compressible quantum matter state? So consider a system which, for simplicity, is translationally invariant. It's also a continuous system. And we have a conserved U1 current, so we've got a charge, or a charge density. Yes, charge density is called J, or JT. And so then we take our normal Hamiltonian and just add to this Hamiltonian a piece like mu times JT, and mu is of course then the chemical potential. Then we can ask, what is this ground state of this mu Hamiltonian? And in particular, how does the like the density of that ground state varies with the chemical potential at zero temperature? And like a compressible quantum matter state satisfies the this condition here, that if we take JT to be non-vanishing, and if we take a derivative with respect to mu, so that's non-zero. And of course, we know examples of such compressible states. So the classical examples are either like solids break the translational invariance, so, or superfluids, so superfluids break in U1 spontaneously, or even more, or Fermi liquids. And Fermi liquids are basically do not break the U1 and also do not break translational invariance. So the question is, if we have a compressible state, and so say if we know that the compressible state neither breaks a U1, so it's not a superfluid, neither breaks translational invariance, do we know if it's a Fermi liquid? And for sure, that's an interesting question. And at least what we know, or at least there's no counterexample, that all these systems which neither break U1 or nor the translational invariance should have to do something with fermions. There should be a Fermi surface. But of course, not every fermionic system has to be a Fermi liquid. We know at least one example which is not a Fermi liquid. And so the one example, and I guess everybody nowadays quotes this one example, is basically if you look at the phase diagram of high temperature superconductors. So here is basically an external parameter like hole doping. Here we have got the temperature, and in this phase diagram we have got a superconducting phase, and here you see, okay, it's roughly so up to 100 Kelvin here. So that's just a picture of a string theorist, how at least I understand high TC superconductor, so that's very simplified. And so here we have got a superconducting dome, and this kind of superconducting phase might be associated or might be controlled by a quantum critical point, where basically here at least one of the phases basically meets that T up to T equal to zero, and this is hidden behind the superconducting dome. And so what we understand is this Fermi liquid phase. What we don't understand, and this is really also an example of a compressible state, are these strange metal phases. Because in this strange metal phase, the resistivity is linear in the temperature, and at least very close here, and so we don't know if we can model this from a kind of continuous system, or if we can write down even a model which has these properties. So I won't talk about strange metals today. You should view it a bit more broader. So you should think, like, take any kind of compressible state. So can we learn something from that by using ADS-CFT? Or even better, can we classify different states, compressible states? And using kind of these insights, probably, that's not very good, but probably we also get new insights in this strange metal phase. So, okay, I guess I don't have to remind you what this technique, what I call it, the ADCFT correspondence really is. So the ADCFT correspondence is basically a decoupling of open and closed strings. So we have got here a stack of these three brains, and this stack of open strings on the D3 brain basically generates some Young-Mills theory plus some supergravity. But we can also view this stack of D3 brains, particularly as very heavy objects curving in the space, so viscous thrust radius, the 5 times S5. So I guess everybody knows it here. So. And so Maldacena conjectured then in 1997 that n equal to 4 super Young-Mills is dual or is equivalent to type 2 D-string theory on asymptotically at 5 times S5. Here, and during that talk, and as always, we take the large NC limit and also the strong coupling limit, where Young-Mills squared times NC is much, much larger than 1, so that supergravity is reliable. And we also know that we can calculate in principle sources and vessels of operator by looking at boundary asymptotics of certain fields. And the partition function we can also calculate by just looking at minus the supergravity on shell action, and like log C is minus the supergravity on shell action. So, but of course, we can also generalize this. And for example, if we are interested in fundamental quarks which can propagate, say, in 3 plus 1 dimensions, then Karp and Katz in 2002 showed that you just have to embed the 7 brains into this background. And I'll show you later how these 7 brains are aligned into these 10 dimensions. And mesons would then correspond to fluctuations of these 7 brains. So basically, finite temperature is then given just as a black hole. It's also the same temperature, so the Hawking temperature T is related to the temperature in the finite temperature field theory. And finite density is engineered by a non-zero gauge field AT. And using all these receipts, what we always can study is the phase diagram. We can study meson spectra, can study transport coefficients. So, what do I have in mind? So, I have in mind the following system, which I always call the D3D7 system. So, we have NC D3 brains aligned in the 0, 1, 2, and 3 direction of our 10-dimensional space. And later, this NC D3 brains will then be replaced by the background, so by ADS 5 times S5, and then 5 form RR flux as usual. And besides these D3 brains, we also embed NFD7 brains in such a way that we also have like the D7 brains in 0, 1, 2, and 3 direction, but also we have 4 additional directions. And so it's a kind of a 4ND intersection. So we have got 4 Neumann-Dirichlet directions here. So this system is supersymmetric. It preserves half of the supersymmetry of n equal to 4 super Young-Mills, so half of the Poincaré supersymmetries. And in particular, basically, if we look now at this diagram here, so this black line here are the ND3 brains, and the 3-3 strings ending both, like with both ends on this D3 brain, give rise then to the super Young-Mills fields of n equal to 4 super Young-Mills. And these are then, if we replace the ND3 brains, are replaced them by closed strings or supergravity fields in ADS5 times S5. Moreover, we also have 3-7 strings. And the 3-7 strings, basically one end is on the D3 brain, the other end is on the 7 brain. So basically the D3 brain encodes which kind of color degree of freedom it carries, and the 7 brain, like which color charge, which flavor charge it carries. So these are really the quarks in the fundamental or anti-fundamental representation. And of course, in basically, if we replace the ND3 brains by the background, then we don't have any more 3-7 strings. But what we have is our 7-7 strings. And these 7-7 strings are then kind of bound states of our quarks, like bound states of bilinears in the quarks, like mesons or mesinos. Okay. So, of course, it's very difficult to include the backregulation, like to do really an honest string theory calculation, like using the T7 brains, calculate the back reaction to the ADS5 times S5 background, and so on. So what we do in the following, and this is called the probe limit, we take a finite number of T7 brains, called NF, and we take this to be fixed, and we take NC going to infinity. So then, what we can do on the gravity side is we can neglect the back reaction of the T7 brains to our geometry. This means we just study probe T7 brains embedded into ADS5 times S5, and then we have, as always, if we don't switch on any gate fields which live on the T7 brain, then we have to minimize the vault volume of the T7 brain. So, this limit on the gravity side, what is the dual limit on the gauge theory side? On the gauge theory side, this corresponds to ignoring basically loops in the flavor in the fundamental degrees of freedom, so no quark and squarks loops. So we neglect this. Lattice gauge theory is known as the quenched approximation. So this quenched approximation has a big advantage. Remember, I want to describe condensed matter systems controlled by a quantum critical point. So it would be nice if my dual field theory is conformal, so the beta function should be zero. If you calculate the beta function of this D3-7 system or of the corresponding field theory, then what you see is that the beta function is not zero, it's positive. So in the UV, you get a Landau curve. But it is suppressed by NF divided by NC. So if we take on a gauge theory side, the quench approximation, then the beta function is also zero. And that's good because, as I said, we want to describe condensed matter systems, so they should be conformal, so the beta function should be zero. So this slide is a bit technical. The only message you should take from that slide is we know the dual field theory. That's a big advantage if you compare it to other approaches in ADS-CMT, like ADS-CFT applied to condensed matter systems, because we can also, in principle, say at weak coupling what happens. We know the elementary fields. We, of course, know all the symmetries. We know the Lagrangian. So we can also do perturbative calculations and compare between results from the gravity side and results from the field theory side. So just to remind you, so just look at this probe brain embedding. So we have got here four directions which are wrapped by the T7 brains. So we expect here an SO4 symmetry along these directions. And SO4 is just SU2 times SU2. And here we have got an SO2 or a U1 in the 8 and 9 directions. So all the fields of that corresponding field theory should somehow transform under these two or these symmetries. So the symmetries are, these are just the SU4 symmetry, SU2 phi times SU2R, and this is just the U1R, so the SO2 in the 8 and 9 direction. And of course, we can rewrite the N equals to 4 Sibbing-Mills theory in terms of N equals to 2 Silber fields. So these two here are the hyper N equals to 2 hypermultiplet and N equals to 2 vector multiplet, which together give again the N equals to 4 Sibbing-Mills or Young-Mills gauge multiplet. But besides these degrees of freedom, we also have hypermultiplets, or one hypermultiplet, or if you take an F D7 branch, we have an F of these hypermultiplets, transforming in the fundamental and anti-fundamental representation of our gauge group. So the squarks are called Q always, and the quarks are called psi. And okay, the squarks are scalars, the quarks are fermions. And so these are the quantum numbers. In particular, you see there are charged and a symmetry which is called U1 baryon. So if I just have one flavor brain, then basically I can rotate psi and psi as e to the I alpha psi and psi bar as e to the minus I alpha psi, and that is basically just the U1 baryon symmetry. If I have got an F of these brains, then I've got a U and F symmetry, so a flavor symmetry, extended one, but I always can take the U1 subgroup corresponding to the baryon symmetry. And also, we know the Lagrangian, so no details, you don't have to remember any details. of that Lagrangian, I just want to show that we know it in principle, and we can do calculations. And we also know how the scalar meson operators and the vector meson operators and flavor currents look like. So the flavor currents, vector meson operators are basically just bilinears in the quarks and squarks, and in principle, you can also add here x. So x are just the fields in the x in the 8 or 9 direction. So you can take arbitrary products of that fields in the 8 or 9 direction. This should be symmetrized. Okay. So good. So let's go to the interesting stuff. So, how does the low energy effective action of these new degrees of freedom, of the flavor degrees of freedom, look like? And to be honest, that's very difficult. For a single DP brain, we know the answer, and therefore I always like to talk just about an F equal to 1, like about one hypermultiplet, because then we know that the DBI action is given by this term here, so it's and the Western mean action is given by this term here, where this is basically a shorthand notation. So this is a form, so e to the f, this contains like a 0 form, 2 form, and so on. And basically this integral just picks out the correct form here, such that the dimensionality is the dimensionality of the DP brain, namely p plus 1. And f in these formulas, so okay, so here you will, I guess, missed the 2 pi alpha prime, so I said alpha prime to be 1 divided by 2 pi, so that they are gone. So the Fs are basically field strength tensors, so this is dA, where A is the corresponding gauge field. So then we take just a single DP brain, it's just an U1 gauge field. If you would take now like an F hypermultiplet, then these DBI and Westermeier actions, they are not really known precisely. They are only known up to order f to the 4, f to the 5, and then there are deviations. So there's a prescription, but there are deviations also from that prescription known. So there's not really a nice formula for that action for coincident DP brains. Okay, so beforehand I mentioned this baryon number current J mu, and this J mu is now mapped to this U1 gauge field A mu, which is hidden basically in this field strength sensor here. So, in the following, I will consider this D3, D7 brain setup, which I showed you earlier, at finite baryon number density. So the setup on the field theory side is we have n equal to 4 supersymmetric gangways theory with gauge group SUNC, and always, as always, we take the large NC limit and also lambda going to infinity. And to that theory, we couple just 1 n equal to 2 hypermultiplet, and this should have mass m, and we also switch on a chemical potential mu for the U1 baryon symmetry. So, of course, the first question is, what happens at t equal to 0? So, something special has to happen if, like mu, which is something like an energy per particle, is equal to the mass of the bare quark mass. And it turns out that if mu is less than m, then basically jt, so the density, vanishes, and also the condensator, like psi by psi, has to vanish. If mu is larger than m, then jt here is proportional to mu squared minus m squared times mu, so it's non-zero. And psi by psi is also non-zero. And basically, for this mu larger than m, this is a really compressible state, because you just can take the derivative with respect to that quantity with respect to mu, and then you get something non-zero. So that's a compressible state. So here, I didn't write an equal sign because I neglected some factors, like factors of nf times nc. Okay, so what are the properties of this compressible state? Do we already know what it is? So, in fact, this compressible state, also it's like one of the simplest one we can think of, like in language of gauge gravity duality, has very unusual properties. And so, for example, if we take the mass to zero, but introduce a small temperature. So finite temperature, the temperature should be much, much smaller than mu. Then, of course, if it would consist out of fermions or bosons, then we would think that the heat capacity either goes like linearly with T or like T cubed. But it turns out, and this is a calculation by Carlson and Starnet from 2008, that the heat capacity goes like T to the 6. So, okay, what is it? It's not made out of fermions or bosons, it's something else. Moreover, you can also look at the neighborhood of this quantum critical phase transitions. So basically, you look at mu bar, at a kind of non-relativist, which is mu minus m. And if mu minus m is much, much smaller than mu m, so this corresponds to some kind of non-relativistic limit. Because like the energy per particle minus their rest mass is very much, much smaller than the rest mass somehow. So this really corresponds to a non-relativistic field theory with C equal to 2. So, okay, that's what you would have guessed. But it also turns out that its hyperscaling is violated. So this hyperscaling violation, theta is 1. And that's interesting because somehow this was is not expected, because all these quantities here, they satisfy they didn't give a hint like that there should be a hyperscaling violation. And I also have to admit that this hyperscaling violation can be seen on the level of thermodynamics. But so far, because we didn't include any back reactions, we cannot see it like on the level of metric, for example.
So
yeah.
Are you going deep level theta equals to 1 even at the back reacted level, or that's just an expectation?
That's just an expectation. So that's not settled. What I also can say is, instead of the D3D7 system, later I will also look at the D3D5 system. That effectively has two spatial dimensions. And there it also turns out that theta is 1. So why do I tell you this story? Because according to Sachdev, if theta is D minus 1, where these are the number of spatial dimensions, then we should have hidden Fermi surface. So it's, in some sense, this D3D5 system should have a hidden Fermi surface, which can be detected by calculating the entanglement entropy. But as far as I know, the entanglement entropy can only be calculated by including the back reaction and so on. So what you're asking is really an interesting question. Can we do the back reaction, in particular for D3D5? Can we then also see that we get a hidden Fermi surface, like an area law violation in the entanglement entropy? That would be really nice. Okay, so I just want to show you the dual gravity description of these compressible states, because later on I want to explain you these modular spaces, and I need this as a first step, basically. So if you take NCT3 brains in this direction, and NFT7 brains in this direction, then we know that the NCT3 brains just give rise to an ADS5 times S5 metric, and here the wrapping factor I call C, so C is 1 divided by R to the 4. And for later purposes, not for now, but for later, I also need the 5 from RR flux, and in particular, I need C4 along the field theory directions along 0, 1, 2, 3, and 0, 1, 2, and 3, which is given by 1 divided by C, so basically by R to the 4. And if we want to embed now the 7 brains into this background, and in particular if we consider embeddings which are basically invariant under translations in space and time, because we want to describe something translationally invariant, and if we also force that the embedding should be invariant under rotations and under parity on the field theory side, as well as under rotations of the SO4 symmetry in the 4, 5, 6, 7 and SO2 in the 8, 9 directions, so along these, basically, these symmetries, then it is very convenient to use the following coordinate system. Instead of dr squared plus r squared ds squared s3, you just ds squared s5, you just wrote d rho squared plus rho squared of ds squared of an s3 plus dy squared. So this y has 8 and 9 index, so it's like it's in this direction here. Okay, so let's now use this embedding, and for just for simplicity, just to show it here, we also take that y of rho, which gives us basically the mass of the flavor field. We also take y of rho to be being to zero, so we just consider massless flavors. And so this determines the mass, basically this y of rho. This is the only thing which basically specifies the embedding into ADS5 times F5. But we also have gauge fields on our brain. And so the only non-zero component of the gauge field, which we want to switch on, is AT. Because AT, as I told you, generates the finite density. And furthermore, because of the symmetries, AT can only depend on rho, on the radial coordinate. So, okay, if we take that embedding, and if we plug it into the DBI action, then it this is the result. The Westomino part of the effective action vanishes for that configuration. And you immediately see that AT doesn't appear here, so you can take you can calculate and conserve quantity D, which is basically the variation of the derivative of that action with respect to AT prime. And then you can take this equation, invert it to get AT prime, which looks like this. And here, I define a quantity rho to the power of 3, which is proportional to d. And let me remind you that d is proportional to the density, like the jt, the left of jt. And of course, we can also integrate this quantity in terms of hypergeometric functions, but we don't need the precise form for later purposes. But just try to memorize that form later, at least that you know where it comes from. Okay, so the question is, we have a very unusual compressible state. It has a T to the 6 heat capacity. It even has a finite entropy at zero temperature. So is it stable? That's a really an honest question. And that's a good question because that system, at least on the microscopic level, has scalars and vectors, has scalars and bosons, fermions and bosons, okay, fermions and bosons, sorry, in it which may condense. And so in order to see whether this system is really stable, what we have to calculate are the quasi-normal modes. Basically, we have to calculate the retarded Green's function, and the retarded Green's function is basically fixed by the location of the poles. And if all the poles of that retarded Green's function are in the lower half plane, then the system is stable. If the imaginary part of the frequency is less than zero. So you can really check for this system all the fluctuations. And so generically, that's what you get. So first, here I drew imaginary part of omega bar, and omega bar is related to omega with a minus sign. So in principle, all the poles, so these dots here are the poles, and the lines show how they change if we switch the momentum. All the poles are in the lower half plane. Also that figure on the first, if you look at it, might tell you something else, but that's really because of that minus sign here. Okay, so take, for example, this pole here. What happens if we increase k, then we follow this line here, for example, one of the lines. For example, the blue line. If we, instead of increasing k for a fixed k, if we increase like the ratio m divided by mu, which you call epsilon, then basically you go up here. So here we varied epsilon from 0, which corresponds to m divided by mu being 0, so mu being large, to up to 0.9. And so our quantum phase transition would be like epsilon being 1. So here, from here to here, we increase epsilon. And
Martin?
Yes?
I'm sorry. I got a little bit lost here. So the D7s are treated in the problem.
Yes.
And these are quaternary modes of what?
Of the flavor fields. So.
Okay, so you're studying quaternary modes of the flavor fields on the D3s. Is that it?
No, these are really like the retarded Green's function of like one scalar meson with itself or with
okay.
But it's like all the operators involved are like yes, these are really just the seven brain fluctuations. Okay, so this is the lowest one. If you go now from here to here, it's basically the same. It's not the same operator. So here, basically, we look at an operator like a bilinear in Q and Q bar with no X8 and X9 inserted. But if you insert some power, like if you like insert 1, then we would be there. And if you include 2, then we would be there, and so on. So that's really the generic, how generically all these retarded Green's function of the poles, how they move in this lower half plane. Okay, but there are two special ones. The first one, which you might guess, is like sound. There should be a sound mode. And we know the sound mode should be gapless. So if you take k to 0, then also the frequency should be 0. Okay, so we know that at k equal to 0, it should sit here. Then there's another mode. This is this mode here. And in particular, there's not only just one mode, but an infinite family of different modes, which are also gapless, because at k equal to 0, the frequency is 0. So these are gapless modes, and they should be somehow associated with some probably Motley space on the, in the field theory. So this was very unexpected for us. So, as I told you, we didn't find any perturbative instabilities. Perturbative means just looking at small fluctuations around the equilibrium, or around this ground state. Then, all the particles, they see effectively an ADS2. This means that if you look at the equations for the fluctuations, then in the deep infrared, then they seem to be like derived from effectively an ADS2. So there should be something going on with a 0 plus 1 dimensional CFT. So at least the degrees of freedom should be described effectively by such a CFT. And as I said, we have two low energy modes. One, boring one, because we know that it should appear, the 0 sound. Another one, which is more interesting, this R-spin diffusion. So it's a pole in OSI, OSI. And this O, this operator, is really Q. So this is my scalar, or my squark, Q Decker sigma IQ. So it's really a meson, it's a scalar meson. Plus, of course, because we are supersymmetric, I plus dot dot dot, where there are also the psi bob psi in it and so on, which I omitted here. And this O, they transform under 3 under this SU2R symmetry. So what are these modes? And this triggered now the following. This paper here from August 2012. So these R-spin diffusion modes, they are gapless because we really identified a modulus space on the field theory side. And even if we check just one flavor degree, an f equal to 1, we claim we have a U1 instanton. And that's, of course, U1 instantons don't exist. Just on R4, what you can do is you can look at a non-commutative R instanton, Nekrasov instanton, but this is also not the Nekrasov instanton, it's something else. And I show you precisely why it can exist. So in order to see that, I have to remind you how this D37 system looks like, and I quoted that table again because I also included here now how I call my coordinates, so x0 to x3 are the field theory directions. The directions which are wrapped by the D7 brain, but which are transversal to the D3 brain are called C1 to C4, and the two directions which are transversal to both types of D brains are called Y1 and Y2. Okay, so this action of the D7 brain then in this way, where we also have to include now the West amino term. So it's a pullback of C4. So note C4 lives in the X0 to X3 space, at least the one part of it. And then it's wedge F. And so the Fs, such that it's non-zero here, should live then on this C1 to C4 space. And so this term does only contribute if like the integral of F is non-zero, of course. So it's really something like an instant term. And what we look at is we want to preserve the same symmetries as beforehand, like translation invariance in time and space, parity, rotation in the space-like directions. I also want to preserve the SO2 in the 8 and 9 directions, but unlike beforehand, the symmetry in the SO4 symmetry in the 4, 5, 6, and 7 direction is broken down. So this allows me the following ansatz, where A is the gauge field, psi is just any volume coordinate. So A of psi has to be restricted. We need a kind of time component of A, because this gives rise to the finite density, but beforehand it could only depend on rho, now it can depend on C. And we also have this part here, where the AIs are now basically the indices in the 4 to 7 directions, which are now labeled with C1 to C4. So this is these live in these directions. So that's the answers which we choose, or the most general answers we can think of. And now if you plug everything back into your action, then your action looks like this here. And what I do now is a very old trick. So I just use a certain inequality for the square root of the determinant of this piece here. And this holds because like the I and J, they run over from 1 to 4, so you can think of G and F, so like of the metric, so this is an effective metric, and of the field strength as 4 by 4 matrices, where G is symmetric and F is anti-symmetric. And so then you know that this inequality has to hold. And if you put in now this inequality into our action, back into our action, then we get this result here. And in particular, SD7 is smaller or equal to that here. And now because the free energy, or preferred thermodynamic ensemble, is minus the on-shell action, you see that the free energy has to be larger or equal to some value. So in particular, we can identify what is the ground state with that given symmetries. And the ground state is basically satisfied, so this one here is minimized, if I take Fij to be self-dual with respect to the metric Gij. And Gij was given by delta ij minus, and then diat, where at is non-zero, and djat. And if I plug back in this into here, then what I get back is basically SD7 as minus tau D7 integral over D4C square root of determinant of Gij. And I can calculate this. And if I calculate this, then, and I assume that AT of C just depends now on rho only, then I get back the action which I showed you beforehand, like this rho to the third square root of 1 minus AT prime squared. Okay. So in order to get now like solution with self-dual F, I don't have to solve the equation of motion of this complicated action here. What I really only have to do is we have to follow the following receipt. So first we solve the equations of motion for AT of C. If only the radial direction is four-dimensional space matters, then we already solved that, and that's the case which I'm looking at, which we're looking at. And then, in order to get the self-dual Fij, I just have to solve the self-duality condition. Okay, so let's solve it for two different limits. So let's solve it first for zero density. For zero density, AT is zero, so my metric Gij is just delta ij, And we all know that if I do this receive, I would get instant U1 incitons, but these U1 incitons are singular. So, okay, there are no bodily space at zero density. Now let's do the same at non-zero density. And of course, you might think, oh, that's complicated to solve. But if I really plug in, and beforehand I derived that AT prime of rho has this form here, and I know that rho to the power of 3 is proportional to the density, then I realize that I can rewrite this metric GIJ. Basically, it's conformally equivalent to a flat metric up to this conformal factor. And this conformal factor, you see, that it vanishes for a certain rho. So basically, rho goes from some constant times rho 0 to infinity. So what I effectively do, out of my four-dimensional space, I cut out a ball. And okay, no surprise, but that's the picture behind. Suppose now, and that's just a kind of a Gedanke experiment. Suppose I basically place now the center of my inciton within that ball, which is included from my space-time. Then it's perfectly regular because I just have to integrate over everything outside the ball, and that gives me a finite action, so it's perfectly finite. Of course, I'm not allowed, at least for these 3D7, to put an inciton centered around here, because then I've got, again, that problem that is singular. So the moduli space basically is given by all the incitons somehow sitting inside that ball here. And this characterizes me different states in that moduli space. So like this A, so my vector field looks like then this. So it's like, just take L to be 1. So this is the lowest vector harmonic. Then it's just 1 divided by rho par to the L to the 2 times some coefficient, CL. And we chose here A rho bar to be 0. And of course, this coefficient alone does not satisfy any quantization condition, but we haven't proven that, but we believe that all the kind of different arbitrary constants, if you sum them up, or if you square them first and then sum them up, that this gives rise to a quantization condition which could something you give like f h f, so our inciton number. Okay, so this node A alpha is then dual to an operator OL minus. And if I take L to be 1, this is really precisely the operator where we identified this gapless mode. So it's basically Q take a sigma IQ. So here we really showed that this is that basically these kind of moduli space is really responsible for that, for these gapless modes. Okay, and we can also show that the VEF of OI, so an arbitrary VEF, does not change the Helmholtz free energy, nor it changes the grand canonical potential or the energy of the flavor fields. So really, this is really a moduli. And so far, I just looked at massless flavor fields, and the whole story goes also true for massive flavors. It's not too much changes. So just for presentation, I wanted to restrict to massless flavors. Okay, so we can basically do the same for D3D5, and it's not surprising how the self-duality condition should look like. So now the D3 planes also align along 0 to 3, and the D5 along 0, 1, 2, and C1, C2, and C3. And I take also, again, this ansatz here, which you know from beforehand, and just by rederiving it or kind of using kind of a scalar vector duality, we know how the self-duality condition looks like, so this is the self-duality condition. Now the situation is a bit different in comparison to D3.7. We know that there are solutions at zero temperature of that equation which are perfectly fine. So basically what we have is we have a zero density Higgs branch, and we also have a non-zero density Higgs branch for D3.5. So don't want to give you any details, I just want to give you a picture, that's better, I guess. So suppose I look at a generic point on my Higgs branch, either zero density or non-zero density. So then we just have a spike, so this is basically, this is the x3 direction, this is the c1 and c2 direction. So we just have here a spike. So that's really a very generic point on my Higgs branch. And this basically corresponds just to a kind of an instanton, or after scalar vector duality, of an object sitting outside the circle. So these were, in D37, these were forbidden, now they are allowed. But nevertheless, I can also have such an object sitting inside that circle. Note that the circle only exists at a finite density. And so what you get basically is such a solution. So if you really look at such an object really sitting right at the origin here. But then, because then just using electrostatics, you know that you can represent that object like but just an charge here equally distributed on the sphere. And this is basically such an object here. Of course, what you can also do is you can take any other point in that circle here, but from electrostatics we also know that then the charge distribution on that sphere has no longer only a monopole moment, but also dipole moment, quadrupole moment, and so on. Like all others are switched on. So if we go away from that origin with our new finite density solutions, then basically we switch on all higher nodes. So. Okay, so why did I tell you this whole story? The interesting part comes now. And I've got 5 or 10 minutes, so that's perfect. I think this moduli space was a missing link, at least to get some handle on the classification of compressible states within the propran systems. Just look at that table. And so that's just basically case-by-case evidence, or just collected evidence. So we know that for any 4nd direction, we really proved that, we have such a moduli space. So basically that singles out the 4nd from the 6nd and 8nd intersections of programs where you can't have that expansion. We also know that only on the 6nd directions, we have this Nakamura-Oguri park instability, like an instability at finite momentum. We can't have this in 4nd and 8nd. And if we just look at now at the 8nd systems, in particular, so the 8nd systems, they only have, they are fermionic, they only have fermions in it, but are supersymmetric and stable. So then for the case if you have just 0+1 dimensional fermions, like condor-like impurities, then we know that these are supersymmetric. So this is known in a paper by Camino Paredes and Ramallo from 2001, so even before adding flavor brain state safety. And if you look at an HND direction with 1+1 dimensional fermions, then we know that this system also has a chiral anomaly. In particular, the U1, the baryon U1 is then anomalous. So, and therefore, it's absent. Okay, the only, so this is really a collected evidence of which kind of probe brain system did we include in our analysis. So these are basically all DP brains in a DQ brain background. Okay, not all. So like for 6nd probrains, we know that these are not supersymmetric, so they are unstable. But because like the volt, like the scalar along the volt volume always is at least one scalar is below the Brayton-Luna-Friedman bound. But what you can do is you can switch on fluxes on your compact space and at least stabilize this one mode, which was beforehand under the Brayton-Luna-Friedman bound, such that it's now above the Brayton-Luna-Friedman bound. Okay, so this is are the 6nd probrains. Probably what you miss are the 0nd, but the 0nd are not so interesting because if you give them a mass, then they don't have any coincident directions. And also the 2nd probrain systems. And the 2nd would be interesting because they have just scalars. But as far as I know, and I did read an extensive literature review, but probably someone in the audience knows the system. I know of I don't know any stable 2ND system, or at least a 2ND system which can be stabilized. So if you know one, let me know. I would be really interested, and then we can have another column here and see if it fits in. What we also included are basically the D6 brain in ABJM wrapping ADS4 times RP3, the D4 brain wrapping ADS3 times CP1. That's a difficult one because you see that D4 brain has a chiral anomaly and has an Higgs branch. Basically, the Higgs branch comes from the fact that there is a pullback of C3 on the ADS3, wedge an F on the CP1, which then also gives rise to a cancellation of the DBI and Westermino term. So this would give rise to the Higgs branch. On the other side, there's also a term like a pullback of C1 on the on CP1, but also an F-wedge F term. And if you integrate this F-wedge F term in this, because they are non-compact dimensions, you get an A-wedge F term. So then you get this chiral anomaly. So that's the only brain which has two different properties. And what we also include is like the 8 brain wrapping ADS3 times CP3. Okay, one other thing I want to say is that this classification arises purely by looking at Westermino terms. And this is one remark. And the second remark is somehow I promised you a classification table where we only include field theory data. And of course, on the field theory side, we can see if it's an Higgs branch and strapped instability, supersymmetric, or chiral anomaly. That's for sure. But we can't observe it if it's 4ND, 6ND, or 8ND. So we should really think of what do we have to write down here? What are the field theory data? So, and does this table also hold for generic probe brain system? Can we prove it somehow and so on? So I guess that's a good point to summarize and to have some open questions. So as I said, probe brain systems at finite density are an interesting system on their own, because first we know in Lagrangian, so we can do weakly coupled analysis, and they have really interesting like compressible quantum metastates. So we know that these systems, at least perturbatively, like in the probe limit, are stable. At least the D3D7 is explicitly checked. We hope that the others, like D3D5, D3D3, and so on, they're also stable. But of course, we know that if we go beyond that probe limit, that something should happen, like the D3 brain should be sucked into the D7 brain, for example, in D3D7. So we know that there should be an instability. And okay, of course, a nice candidate is again this operator which corresponds to the moduli space, because it sits right at the origin. So it's we don't need much that it's in the upper half plane and that the system gets unstable then. So okay. So in finite density systems, we get a new 0 plus 1 dimensional CFT, and probably we just have to look at the. And there are Higgs system, and probably just have to get there out a nonlinear sigma model and can derive that 0 plus 1 dimensional CFT. Okay, that's just words. we have gapless modes in low energy spectrum, zeros under an R spin current. And the R spin current is gapless, and as I said, an emergent moduli space at finite density. And we can also classify compressible states on a case-by-case basis. That's conjectured, and we hope that it also holds for other cases. So the interesting questions is really, can we justify that classification table? What is the low NFT effective description of these compressible states? Like, can we write down some nonlinear sigma model using our intuition from the from moduli spaces and Higgs branch and so on? And can we also reproduce, using these zero energy states, can we reproduce the extensive ground state degeneracy, like the finite entropy at zero temperature? Is that possible by just counting the instantons to get the right number or not? So for more details, you can look at these three papers, and otherwise, thank you very much for your attention.
Other questions for Martin? So I have one, actually.
Yeah.
Does this if you go to finite temperature, then the instantons still exist, the seizures that you found, or
No, I think, as always, like if you have a moduli space, at least it should not be a moduli space. So you get like a potential, and then at least one state should be preferred, and probably the state where all the VAPs vanish.
Right. So, but you can see how that'll happen in the gravity description.
No, so far we haven't done that, or at least we have some. We don't really have a result by now, but we started doing that. So. Yeah. But I suspect that there's nothing interesting in that direction, so that's okay. Just so, usual mechanism.
So then, do you think the R-spin diffusion will be gapped then at finite temperature?
Yeah, so that's...
Okay, I guess that's the same statement.
Yeah, precisely. So, non-trivial potential.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, let's thank Martin again.